This morning's scripture reading is from Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 through 13. It's on page 830 of the Pew Bible if you want to follow along. We're continuing in a section of Matthew where Jesus is discussing his return. Matthew 25. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. Five of them were foolish and five were wise. For when the foolish ones took their lamps, they took no oil with them. But the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. But at midnight there was a cry, "Here is the bridegroom! Come out to meet him!" Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise answered, saying, "Since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves." And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he answered, "Truly, I say to you, I do not know you. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour." This is the word of the Lord.
Good morning, everybody. So for the last two chapters and chapter 25, Jesus speaks about Judgment Day. Jesus assumes that history and the story of our lives are not like a merry-go-round that never ends, where we all take turns going up and down, round and round. That history is not like a hike up an infinite mountain, where depending on how much effort we put in, we can make a certain amount of additional progress in terms of prosperity and equality. Jesus says history is like a trial. That all of our lives, we are building up evidence, and that it will culminate in a verdict being rendered. And that this verdict that comes to us on Judgment Day, in this case, guilt and innocence will not determine just some time in prison or a fine or even the electric chair. But this verdict has eternal stakes. That on Judgment Day, all of the infinite years of our lives will be decided. And he's telling a series of stories. This one is the second in a series of four that help us see Judgment Day and help us to prepare for Judgment Day. So none of these stories, including the one we're going to walk through today, cover everything. They're each a slightly different perspective. And the perspective that this one offers is that Judgment Day is like a wedding, which, you know, I don't necessarily think of judgment and weddings as peanut butter and jelly, but Jesus wants us to see judgment as a wedding. In other places in Scripture and in other stories, judgment is something to be feared, something that should cause us to tremble with terror. But in this case, judgment is something to be anticipated, something that should cause us to tremble with excitement. It is a feast day, a party day. And so we're going to work through this story, which tells the story of the wedding of Jesus from the perspective of these 10 virgins. And we'll go through the parable in four sections. So the first section is just verse 1, kind of setting the scene. And what we see here is that you were made to celebrate Jesus. So verse 1, "Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom." So from this we see you were made to celebrate Jesus. The 10 virgins in the story, you can kind of think of bridesmaids. They're definitely a part of the wedding party, but instead of focusing on the bride, they go as representatives of the bride to wait on the groom and then to escort the groom, because a wedding in those days started with the groom leaving his home and sort of processing across town to the house of his bride's father, where she had been living, and collecting her and sort of ceremonially bringing her into his home. And so these virgins came on behalf of the bride, and they surrounded the groom, and they had their lamps so that the groom would be illuminated, so the focus would be on the groom, and they traveled with him. That's, if you've been a part of weddings, really that's the point of everyone at the wedding except the bride and groom, is to celebrate the bride and groom. So that translates for us. And these, at different points in the sermon, we'll talk about the 10 virgins as a whole and then them divided into the wise and foolish. When they're all together as a whole, they're meant to represent all of humanity. Which means that every human being exists to celebrate Jesus. That is your purpose. Whether you walked in here this morning as a Christian or not, you were designed to celebrate Jesus. There's something called the Westminster Catechism, which was a document of foundational theological truth that was written several hundred years ago, and it starts off by saying the chief purpose of all humanity is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. We were made to celebrate God. But why were we made for that? I have a friend, his name's Josh Berkowitz, not a follower of Jesus, somebody I respect enormously. And he and I were discussing this several years ago, and he said, this is really what I don't get. It really seems like God is an egomaniac, that he just made a bunch of people to pay attention to him and hold their pom-poms and say, rah, rah, me. And I understand that. It seems like God is shining the spotlight on himself. But I want to back up, and I want you to think about the best and most joyful moments of your life. My contention would be that all of them have to do with celebrating a good thing outside of yourself. It could be something relatively small, a meal you ate that was so good that you weren't thinking about the fact that it was going to be gone soon or the fact that this was going to change what you saw on the scale the next morning. You were just enjoying, celebrating the goodness of the food. A sunset that you saw that took you completely outside of yourself and had you entirely focus on the goodness in the sky on the western horizon. A conversation you had with another person where you actually listened to them. You weren't spending the time that they were talking preparing your response or comparing yourself to them in some way, but you were just focused on and celebrating them. These are the best moments of their lives. And a good life, then, is a life of celebrating the good things outside of ourselves in proportion to their goodness. A beaver's victory is a good thing. And it is a good and joyful thing to celebrate it and get outside of yourself. But it should not be celebrated to the same degree as the birth of your child. These celebrations need to be in proportion. So, if Jesus is who he claimed to be, then a life of celebrating him is the best and most joyful life of all possible lives. If Jesus really is God made flesh, come to earth to show us the perfect way to live, to die on our behalf, to rise from the grave, so that we might have eternal life with him, then that is more worth celebrating than anything else. And so when God creates you to celebrate him, he is also creating you for your own joy. John Piper, a pastor, said about that question in the Westminster Catechism, he said, that's not quite it. It's you are made to glorify God by enjoying him forever. That it's not sometimes you glorify God and sometimes you enjoy him, but that your enjoyment of him is what glorifies him. In the same way that your enjoyment of a sunset or a meal or a friend is what glorifies that sunset or meal or friend. This is what we were made for. So then the natural question would be, okay, fine, how? How do we celebrate Jesus? How do we glorify God by enjoying him forever? I am not even going to pretend to attempt a full answer to that question. It is way too big and way too complex for that. What we can do is look at the story we're given and how these virgins are intended to celebrate the bridegroom. And we see in the story three ways that they're meant to celebrate him. They're meant to wait on Jesus, they're meant to illuminate Jesus, and they're meant to feast with Jesus. Wait and illuminate and feast. Right here at the start of the story, the virgins are waiting on the groom, right? They're sitting outside of his house, waiting for him to be ready. And that waiting is a form of celebrating and honoring, right? If we set up a meeting and I show up 30 minutes late and you choose to wait, in waiting, you're honoring me, saying I'm choosing to make waiting to spend time with Zach more important than whatever else I could be doing. That's a kind of celebration. And weddings work like this, right? Vanessa and I were engaged for 17 months, which engagement months are like dog years. It's basically an entire lifetime. That's a lot of waiting. And what marked that time, because we were living in different states, was that during regular life, I still went about all the things that I ordinarily did, but with this sense of dissatisfaction, that this isn't all there is. I would actually sit in class and work out exactly how many hours it was until my plane would land in Memphis next time, and I would get to see her again. And so we're meant in waiting on Jesus to go through this life, still doing the normal things, but with a clear sense that this isn't all there is. And then the other thing that marked that time of engagement was that every 3 or 4 weeks, once I had saved up enough money, I would fly out to Memphis and drive down to Mississippi and visit Vanessa. And we would have this time, this couple of days, where all normal activities stopped. And we were just together. The Bible calls that Sabbath. Our lives of waiting on Jesus, of celebrating him, are meant to mostly be normal lives, but then have these periods of time where we stop. We cease being productive. I don't know what a normal day looked like for the virgins, but it didn't look like sitting around on the doorstep of somebody else's house waiting on them. But we're meant to have these times where we pause, we become deliberately not busy, put away all of the to-do lists, and are together for the sake of Jesus. That's waiting on him. That's the first way we celebrate him. The second way is by illuminating him, right? The reason that the virgins are there is so that when the bridegroom goes through town, he might be lit up, and everyone in the whole town would pay attention to him. They would arrive right around or shortly before dusk. And then the bridegroom was supposed to emerge just as dark was settling in. And then they would travel. And you got a picture of the first century, right? There's no street lights. There's no lights on in any of the houses. The whole town is dark. Every bit of light in the town is supposed to be focused on the groom. And our lives are supposed to work that way. All of the light of our lives is supposed to be focused on Jesus. So we can't be showy Christians who think an awful lot of ourselves and are impressed with how we're doing. And we can't be stealth Christians either, where we go around like we're in the Kingdom of Heaven CIA and nobody ever knows that at whatever good we do is done for Jesus. Our lives are meant to illuminate him. So we celebrate him by waiting on him, we celebrate him by illuminating him, and we celebrate him by feasting with him, right? This is where, in the end, only 5 of the virgins, but all of them are meant to end up in the marriage feast. They're meant to end up at the party. Celebrating Jesus is supposed to be a celebration. If you go to a wedding and the bridesmaids and the groomsmen are standing up at the front like this, you know, they went down the aisle, you know something is amiss. If our lives of following God have this posture to them, oh, Sunday morning again? Do I really have to write that tithe check? I had big hopes for vacation this year. We're missing the whole point. God isn't calling you to a life of drudgery. He's calling you to come into the feast. If Jesus really is worth celebrating, then being with him is better than whatever you might be giving up. So, we are all made to celebrate Jesus. That's verse 1. Only 12 verses to go. Second section, verses 2 to 4. And here we see that wisdom is committing to the celebration. Starting in verse 2, 5 of the virgins were foolish and 5 were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. Okay, so now instead of seeing the 10 virgins together as all of humanity, we have them divided into the wise and the foolish, which means the wise are the ones who understand what their basic purpose is and focus on that purpose of celebrating Jesus. And the foolish are the ones who don't understand what their basic purpose is and so fail to focus on that. And we see that in this difference with the oil. And what's going on with the oil is that the foolish virgins, they know they're supposed to wait on the bridegroom, and they come prepared to wait on the bridegroom for a reasonable amount of time. General convention said, you show up, and 10, 20, 30 minutes later, the bridegroom is ready, and you all process together, and one lamp full of oil is more than enough for that. And so they come like people who have a bunch of priorities, a bunch of things to celebrate, and they've carved out X amount of time to devote to the bridegroom. The wise come prepared to wait for as long as it takes. They understand that they are to focus on the bridegroom in an open-ended way, that their commitment to him can't have brackets on it. That's the way a wedding party is supposed to work. If you're at a wedding and you're the bridesmaid or the groomsman, then you are there to make an open-ended commitment to the bride and the groom, to ask for nothing and to give whatever you have to give, right? If the bride's shoes break, then the maid of honor goes barefoot. That's how it's supposed to work. It's supposed to be all about the bride and groom regardless. And the wise are the ones that understand this. So our commitment to Jesus is meant to be open-ended. It's not to have brackets or limits on it. It's not, Jesus, I can squeeze celebrating you in between celebrating my career and celebrating my family and celebrating the OSU football team. But whatever you want, it's yours. So Christians, don't try to compartmentalize Jesus. Don't say, Jesus, you can have this much and no more. If Jesus wants to totally upend your schedule, he can do that. If Jesus wants to totally upend your finances, he can do that. If Jesus wants to upend your personality, he can do that. These days we introduce ourselves and almost the first thing we say is whether or not we're an introvert or an extrovert. Jesus is the groom and he has every right to say to the introverts in the room, I want you to spend more time with, talking to, loving on, you know, people. And he has every right to say to the extroverts in the room, yeah, Sabbath for you is going to be silence and solitude with no people. If our commitment to Jesus is open-ended, then that follows. Don't compartmentalize Jesus. Non-Christians, if you're in the room, this means join the party with your eyes open. Jesus is going to ask of you things that you don't necessarily want to give. If you're single, Jesus is going to ask you not to have sex until and unless you get married. And you may not want to give that. If you're proud of your own accomplishments, Jesus is going to ask you to recognize that whatever you think your accomplishments are, they don't count in front of him. And so please join the party. The life with Jesus really is the best life. But don't walk into it thinking you can give Jesus a slice of the pie. He has every right to the whole thing. And of course, again, if Jesus is who he claims to be, then this kind of open-ended commitment is wise. It makes sense. If you're going to Jesus and making an open-ended commitment, you're trading in a lifetime of Big Macs for getting to eat at Block 15 every day. It's a no-duh. Or even when, you know, life is life and you don't get to go to Block 15, the Big Mac reminds you of the real thing. Points beyond itself to what a hamburger should be. So the second section in this parable teaches us that we are to commit to celebrating Jesus in an open-ended way. The third section is verses 5 and 6, and it shows us that we all fail to commit. So verse 5, as the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. But at midnight there was a cry, here is the bridegroom, come out to meet him. In the bigger picture of this discourse that Jesus is giving, staying awake is the fundamental command. If you want to be ready, if you want to obey, then you stay awake. 24, verse 42. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. And none of them do it. Every single one of them is like me on New Year's Eve, right? They attend the beginning of the party, and then they crash. And they don't see midnight. We're back to all 10 virgins, which means we're back to all of humanity. Every last one of us fails in this commitment. Paul says, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. So you can make all kinds of distinctions between people based on their religious performance, based on their economic status, based on their race, based on their age, based on how they vote. But none of those distinctions, and no combination of those distinctions, adds up to worthy and unworthy, to good and evil, to righteous and sinful. We're all unworthy. We're all sinful. We all deserve a verdict of guilty. We're in the same boat together, which means we all need mercy. We all need to be forgiven. We all need the judge to say, even though I should say guilty, I choose to say innocent. And so the question is not, do you need a little bit less mercy than the person sitting next to you? The question is not, can you reorganize your life to make it so that you need a little bit less mercy? The question is, how will you respond to the unavoidable reality that you do need mercy? How will you handle the fact that you need God to forgive you? And that's where we get to the last section in the parable, verses 7 to 12. And here, the fundamental point is, it's not all about you. So here we go, verse 7. Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. But the wise answered, saying, since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves. And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came. And those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered, truly I say to you, I do not know you. So once again, the virgins are divided, and we see pictures of wisdom and foolishness. And it's wisdom and foolishness when it comes to how shall we respond to needing mercy. And foolishness first. I have a lot of sympathy for the foolish virgins here. It really seems like they do everything they can to solve the problem at hand. They recognize, oops, we don't have enough oil. And then whatever will work to get more oil, that's what they do. They ask the wise virgins, hey, can we have some? That doesn't work out. Then they go tromping across town to wake up the oil guy in the middle of the night and say, hey, we really need oil for this thing. They go all in. They're really doing their best. And they get shut out of the feast. And the bridegroom says, I never knew you. Guilty. As hard as they try, as much effort as they put in, as much better as their performance gets, the foolish virgins never stop focusing on themselves. They realize there's a problem and they turn to the wise virgins and they don't say, please. They just say, give us some of your oil. We need to have oil. And when the wise virgins say no, they run off to the store and they get the oil that they need, and then they come back to the feast and they knock on the door and they say, open to us. We've done what we're supposed to do. We have oil now. You need to let us in. Their solution to needing mercy is to try to get themselves to a place where they don't need mercy. And then leverage the work that they've done to make the judge declare them innocent. And it does not matter what work they have done if they bring that attitude. It does not matter how many hours you volunteered, how many dollars you've given away, how many church services you've attended, how many people you've invited into your home. If that's what you bring to the judge and say, you need to declare me innocent. So, watch yourself. Is the trajectory of your life one that is preparing to come before God on the basis of what you have done? Is the primary focus of any given day your resume? Coming before God with that could not be more foolish. The language in verses 11 and 12, where the virgins ask to be let into the feast and Jesus says no, is a deliberate echo of his teaching at the end of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 7. Where Jesus, speaking of judgment day, says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Those guys in chapter 7, their resume is better than the best version of your resume. They go around making prophecies and casting out demons and doing good works. And Jesus doesn't say you didn't do those things. He says you came to me with your resume. And no resume is good enough. All have sinned and fallen short. All are guilty. A picture of how to come before God is, we see a better way of doing this in the person of King David. David did not have a great resume. And after a particularly bleak period in which he had done murder, adultery, lying, maybe a little racism for the icing on the cake, he comes before God in Psalm 51, and he says, have mercy on me according to your steadfast love. According to your abundant mercy, blot out my transgressions. Have mercy according to who you are. Not according to how well I've done or how sorry I am for the bad things I've done or how deep my resolve is to do better next time, but just according to you. That's what we see out of the wise virgins here. Right? They wake up, they realize they've failed, And they trim their lamps and they get ready to illuminate the bridegroom. And the foolish virgins say to them, hey, can we spread some of that out? And they say no, which at first sounds kind of harsh, right? It's better to share. But look at their reasoning in verse 9. But the wise answered, saying, since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves. What the wise virgins are concerned about is that the groom would be illuminated, that there would be light to shine on him. And if they spread everything out in the name of fairness, all the lamps will go out. And there will be no light on Jesus. Their wisdom comes in not losing that focus on Jesus. Yeah, we've screwed up. Yeah, we've fallen short. Our purpose is still to celebrate the groom. We understand that it's not about us. Brothers and sisters, the good news that is so hard to accept, but that if you can accept it is so wonderful, is that your life is not about you. It's not about your greatest strengths. It's not about your most shameful weaknesses. It's not about the moments that you are delighted to put front and center on your resume. And it's not about the moments that you never speak of and you hope never see the light of day. It's not about you at all. It's about Jesus. Your whole life takes place on Jesus' wedding day. And it is about Him. So turn away from your shame. Turn away from your pride. Turn away from, I'm so bad I can't come to Him. And turn away from, well, I've done a little bit better, so maybe I can come to Him now. And just ask Jesus for mercy. Just celebrate the groom. Because in the end, Jesus is a groom worth celebrating. This story that Jesus tells takes place from the perspective of the virgins. But I hope by now you've gotten that just because that's true doesn't mean that they are the main character of the story. It is a wedding story. And the main character in this story is the groom. In Jesus' day, the way that a wedding feast, which was a week long, would start was with this procession, where the groom marches across town in the company of the bridesmaids and collects his bride. But that wasn't the only thing the groom was going across town to do. He was also going to pay the bride price. See, in order to get married, you gave a gift of substantial value to the bride's mother and father to say thank you for raising her and preparing her for marriage. And this was why grooms tended to be so much older than brides, because they needed years and years after reaching physical maturity to accumulate enough wealth to give a proper bride price. It was a costly thing to do. Actually, in right around Jesus' day, the rabbis started allowing for a delayed paying of the bride price. So I could have agreed with Vanessa's mom and dad when we were both 20, and then I might still be paying them off. Because it was just understood, like, it costs too much for a young man. So when Jesus goes to collect his bride, to collect the church, Jesus also goes to pay for her. And the price Jesus pays can't be measured in any of the usual units. It's not in shekels or talents, dollars or cents. It's not in sheep or goats or oxen. It's not in land. Jesus buys his bride with his own blood. He buys an innocent verdict for you by taking a guilty verdict for himself. That walk across town, it didn't end with Jesus a little poorer. It ended with him dead, so that he might win you. That's the nature of Jesus, the bridegroom. And it's his wedding that we are invited to at the cost of his own blood. And you will never, no matter how long you live and no matter how hard you look, you will never find anything or anyone more worth celebrating than a groom like that. You will never find any better life than a life spent celebrating Jesus. Let's pray. Jesus, thank you for paying that price. Thank you for paying with your own blood, and thank you that we are not our own, for we have been bought with that price. Help us to lead lives of celebration, lives of joy and feasting, lives that are rightly focused on you. You're worth it. We put our trust in you.